Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to Your World Today. My name is Anisa Isak. Well, as I said, our interview this afternoon, we will be speaking to Anas Mustafa. He's the communications officer at Cage UK Live, all the way from the UK. And we are looking at the global war on terror. So, Brother Anas, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Are you with us? Ameen, welcome to the show, and good to have you. And I think this is a subject, you know, we've been talking about for a few days now, seeing that the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 having just taken place on Saturday. Mm-hmm. What were the implications of the of a global war on terror, particularly for Muslims?
So the global war on terror unleashed an onslaught on the world itself. It set in motion what has come to become the national security kind of industrial complex, which is kind of an industry that feeds off fear and prejudice and hate, especially Islamophobia against Muslims, to make money and to securitize our societies even more. We've seen the kind of commencement of the forever wars. So on 9/11, the response to 9/11 set in motion the kind of the theory, the concepts of this forever wars, mm-hmm. and wars without borders, without limits, without oversight, without any accountability at all, where people are just figures and the dead don't matter. So this is what the war on terror has unleashed on the world on a global stage. But domestically, in each country, the war on terror has had an implication such that we have seen the introduction of new laws, new policies, which have eroded our freedoms, our rights, and have led us to a situation where, for example, in the UK, it's very openly acknowledged that secret evidence is used in a number of high-profile legal cases, and in fact even introduced in family law cases where there's differences between spouses. And we have surveillance schemes against Muslim communities across in the UK, in the US, and CVE in the UK, Prevent, and so on. So mm-hmm. it's had damaging effects globally. And we know just from the figures, and I'll just mention this and leave it at that, we know that the war on terror has led to the death of nearly a million people globally. It's led to the displacement of about 37 million people across the globe. And this is without counting, you know, the indirect deaths and indirect devastations and destruction of families that has happened as a result of the war on terror and of the laws and policies of the war on terror.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of legislation has been passed around the world to support this? I mean, we're seeing what's happening to the Uyghurs in China. We're seeing what's happening in Myanmar. Are these also part of those, of that, you know, that implications that you've talked about?
Yeah. So each country, I mean, initially, obviously, the war on terror led by the US and the UK and the Western world. Countries thereafter, they co-opted the language of the war on terror, the rhetoric of the war on terror, for their own political aims and goals. Mm-hmm. So we see in many countries across the world, they don't necessarily have a terrorism problem. They don't have any of these issues in their history, but they have terrorism laws. These are designed to crush dissent, to limit political kind of opposition, and to straitjacket people into accepting the narrative from the state on all issues. It's used as a form of control and coercion. In the Western world, we've seen a complete kind of eating away and an erosion of the rights that the European countries and used to pride themselves in. So the right to fair trial has been undermined significantly across the mm-hmm. Western world. As I mentioned earlier, the use of secret evidence, surveillance on communities, the arrest and the persecution of people who speak out against these policies, and using language which seeks to kind of delegitimize and isolate people who call the government to account. So, for example, very recently, there's been just a theater production about Afghanistan, a tribunal, a kind of a public tribunal on Afghanistan, which caused alarm of a number of the kind of pro-war lobby think tanks and politicians. To such an extent, you know, they write stories in the press about this, to demonize those who are seeking accountability. So these are some of the implications of it domestically.
All right. What about how it's fueled Islamophobia across the world? But particularly, we see it in the UK and in the US and parts of Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the war on terror is essentially a war on Muslims. Yeah. The people in Guantanamo are Muslims, 100%. Mm-hmm. You know, the countries that were invaded were Muslim countries.
Yes.
Muslims face the brunt of the legislation, the policies, the rhetoric, the language, the theatrics of the war on terror. So this is very much a war on Muslims, and because of that, in order to justify these policies, they had to use some sort of bogeyman. They had to create a fear and ignite these fears and these prejudices within Western populations in order to justify the passing of these new terrorism laws, which eat away everyone's rights. So the war on terror is inextricably linked to Islamophobia, and they both feed off each other. And the war on terror fans the flames of Islamophobia. Now, if, for example, in the UK, there's the PREVENT strategy, which is meant to kind of stop radicalization.
Yeah? Yes.
But then the scheme seems to be targeting children in their schools and pupils in university who become more overtly religious or become public advocates for justice because they are motivated by their faith and by the things that they see in the world around them, the injustices that they see. So, and the atmosphere that then has allowed, for example, in the wider media and the wider press, the demonization of Islam, the Muslims, the denigration of the woman's hijab and the face veil, the kind of the mocking of the beard and Muslim practices, all of this is part and parcel and is a consequence of the war on terror.
Mm-hmm. So what impact then is the withdrawal by the US and allies from Afghanistan having on the global war of terror?
Just before I touch on that, tomorrow on the 18th of September marks, I think, 20 years since the authorization to use military force was given to President Bush, signed off by the US in order to invade Afghanistan.
So
this is a poignant, very poignant moment and an issue for us to just mark and reflect on. Their departure, no doubt, has been forced by the resistance of the Afghani people and their rejection of occupation and standing up for their right to believe in their faith and to not be kind of subdued by a foreign occupying force. So this is something which we welcome and we congratulate the people in Afghanistan for achieving. Globally, the infrastructure of the war on terror is still intact. However, it has caused a massive shock to the system, and right now we're seeing significant amount of revision. People having much more a wider capacity to look back and to review the 20 years that have passed and reconsider whether the policies that the Western states have embarked on and have essentially enforced on the world, have they been the right course of action? And in order to further that discussion, we at CAGE, alongside over 50 NGOs globally from across the world, have launched the International Witness Campaign, which is to commemorate 20 years of failed wars of the war on terror. Mm-hmm. And bringing about this conversation to tell people that this is a moment for us to reflect, a moment for us to stop and to acknowledge that the war on terror has failed in all of its objectives. It's failed to limit the reach of the groups that they sought to fight. Taliban now is back in power. It failed to preserve the freedoms and rights that the West has proud itself in, because it has eroded them through a series of laws and policies. And it's failed to keep Western countries safer. In fact, right now, the Western countries are no safer now than they were 20 years ago.
Yes.
So these are fundamental issues that the war on terror sought to do. At least it purported, it claimed that it would try to achieve these matters, but it failed. It failed very clearly on all of these issues, and this is a moment for us to kind of reflect and revise and actually push these discussions and force the agenda and say the war on terror has failed. It's time to dismantle it. It's time that we end these policies, and it's time that we try and build safer, fairer societies that are not built on these kind of prejudiced policies.
Mm-hmm. But now, one of the things that fuels these prejudice policies is the language and terminology that's constantly used, particularly within mainstream media. I mean, every day you hear things like extremist, Islamist, jihadist. Yeah. How do we, you know, as the layman out there, get rid of that kind of language? Also, I mean, looking at us as a Muslim radio station, we've got to be careful how we portray the narrative as well. So how do we go about doing that?
Yeah, we need to be very conscious of the language that we use, and we shouldn't be using words and frames of reference which reinforce negative views of Islam and Muslims, such as you rightly alluded to, the word kind of extremist, radical, terrorist, jihadist, Islamist. These are very loaded terms that in the public consciousness, they are made synonymous with Islam, made synonymous with Muslims, made synonymous with aspects of our Sharia, our deen. And hence, when we use these frames, we are essentially, as I said, we are reinforcing negative perceptions of Islam and Muslims. So definitely, the war of words, so to say, we must be on the right side of it. We must, you know, liberate our language and ensure that when we speak about these issues, we avoid these terms, and also to challenge them when they are used, to challenge these terms. Islamist, what does that exactly mean? Does that mean a Muslim who believes that their religion has a role in politics? I mean, we don't call people kind of like, you know, Christianists or Jewishists,
yes,
or whatever. Mm-hmm. We don't use these terminologies. So these terminologies are used to demonize and to scapegoat and to cause fear and anxiety about this particular unknown, and obviously that leads to kind of, you know, hatred of Islam. Unfortunately, if we keep using this language, it's a form of internalized Islamophobia, where we've kind of taken this in and it's become part of our psychology, and that's a really bad place to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jazakallah khair for your time. Quite interesting. I think this is going to take a lot of work by Muslims in particular, and groups like CAGE, to dismantle, first of all, the mindset that many people have already put on and keep using as they see the future. But it is something that we can actually change the perception of people. So, inshallah, let's hope that we can all work together to make sure.
Yeah, just on that issue, I mean, just for listeners, Guantanamo, it began as worst of the worst, and now people acknowledge that these are oppressed men who have a just cause. So that's just an example of how language has changed and how we've made an impact, because Muslim community has come out and said we don't believe the official narrative on this.
Mm-hmm. All right, I think we've got a huge burden on our shoulders that we have to make sure we somehow carry through and hopefully dismantle this entire global war on terror that has put Muslims where we are today, inshallah.
Inshallah.
And shukran for your time. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.